On this week's 51%, taking a breath and the time to regroup, first, a yoga therapist addresses food addictions.
I know that the issue we face with disordered eating is predominantly in women still. Now, in adolescents and children, both genders are more strongly affected every year.
Then, does yoga have to go homeless? And a writer looks at yoga and storytelling. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. By now, school is in full swing, the summer season is a memory, and life is B-U-S-Y busy. Before we allow the holiday season to take hold, now could be a good time to focus and center and breathe, and rewire our brains. First, we turn to Portland, Oregon yoga therapist and educator Sarah Joy Marsh, who has penned Hunger, Hope, and Healing, a guidebook to recovery from disordered eating, food addiction, and body image issues. It's a synthesis of yoga, psychology, and neuroscience. I asked her about her approach to yoga.
Well, if I'm teaching yoga for women struggling with disordered eating patterns or body image issues, or even body-centered self-hatred about something in their body that they wish was profoundly different, my approach to yoga in that case is to guide the student to the brain, body, heart, and mind state where they can experience more self-acceptance, self-kindness, and then learn how to be nurturing towards their goals rather than punitive, condemning, urgent, or anxious about their goals. Because those attitudes, like self-punishment or condescension, they create a biochemical brain state that isn't going to produce results. I mean, generally speaking, when that biochemistry is going, people might urgently move towards their goals, even dogmatically, ruthlessly, but there's often a kickback response later. They might gain the weight again. They might feel badly about themselves as they meet a mark and then they push the mark farther, so they still haven't accepted or met the goal. And I want to help unravel that process that's so cyclical and so conscious/unconscious, like we think we're in charge, but we're actually not in charge because brain chemistry is more powerful than our thoughts when it comes down to it.
Yeah, in reading, I found it interesting that you said, you know, neuroscientists and mental health professionals say, you know, there's more to bending, that we actually have the capacity to rewire traumatized brains, which is, I believe, what you were just talking about. And I'm hoping you could give me a concrete example. You don't have to name it, name anybody, about somebody who comes to you and that you are helping. How does that work?
Yeah, so somebody walks in, let's say she's been yo-yo dieting for 20 or 30 years. She's gained weight, she's lost weight, she's gained it again, she's lost it again, and she's tired. Maybe she's even coming into perimenopause, and she's tired and anxious and now not sleeping that well. And we basically start with, as you just noted, rewiring the brain using diaphragmatic breathing, mindfulness, the movement of the yoga poses that helps to calm her mind, nourish her body, help her to get better sleep and a better perspective on herself. Then we start introducing, how do you stay hydrated? How do you balance your blood sugar? What kind of yoga poses help you really specifically to feel better about yourself? Like, does this person need to feel more optimistic or more grounded or both? And I work with them individually and in small groups so that I can tailor what needs are there with the tools of yoga that we have on hand.
And Sarah Joy, what would be the difference between, say, helping someone with a food disorder versus somebody with a body image issue?
Yeah, so if a body image issue is present and it's mostly thoughts, like self-hatred thoughts, self-critical thoughts, that does have its biochemical response in the brain and body, and I want to help lessen the suffering that goes with that. If somebody also has a food issue, we're looking at quite likely a brain that's a little bit more anxious. And our limbic brain, which is to say our middle brain, we have three parts of our brain. The limbic brain being the middle part is closely related to mammals and to our fight or flight response. So that limbic brain is actually soothed by food, which is unfortunate and also fortunate. But the question is, what kind of food is soothing? And a food disorder is actually dysregulating, so dysregulating that it's hard to think or see clearly. So I really want to help somebody with a food disorder change their relationship to food, to their body and their brain. Let's say I have a chronic restrictor who's been reducing calories for for decades. I might talk with her about nourishing her brain when she eats, rather than thinking of how many calories or perseverating on the kinds of foods. Or if somebody comes and they're bulimic and I can say really outright, you know, bulimia is not great for your brain chemistry, it's not great for your body or for your esophagus, but I understand that purging actually makes you feel better. Let's find other ways to help you feel the relief that you get from purging without using purging as a mechanism. Because the brain can't keep tolerating that, and neither can the body. So how am I going to provide the soothing that somebody's looking for? And once they taste soothing that doesn't have side effects, generally my students are more committed to continuing on that path and not using their caloric restriction or binge purge syndromes.
Now, we're going to get to your book, Hunger, Hope, and Healing, but I wanted to just get to your background, which is you had a food disorder, right? You're a recovered food addict.
I did.
And so what brought you from that? How did you recover? And what brought you from there to a yoga instructor and educator in this realm?
Yeah, well, I started actually as a food restrictor because I grew up in the generation of you count your calories and you burn your calories, and it's really important to be thin and to have a flat stomach. Those were my culturally conditioned messages. And under that, I was food restricting for a long time. And my body as an athlete couldn't tolerate more caloric restriction. So I ended up binging because at the very basic level, that limbic brain I was just talking about was really hungry. My body actually felt like it was in a famine. And if that were the case, you can imagine, like, you know, anything looks like relief if you're going to eat it at that point. So I went from food restriction to food binging, to compulsive exercising to try to manage my body weight. And I was pretty despairing and distressed, and I decided on one auspicious day that I was going to go on a backpacking trip into the mountains by myself. And it turns out that at the top of a steep incline on this backpacking trip, when I set my backpack down and felt the relief of like laying down my baggage, literally, physically, mentally, emotionally, I happened to be at this beautiful outcropping in New Hampshire, and I saw immense beauty, spaciousness, and awe, and I wanted that more than I wanted calorie counting and compulsive exercise and self-hatred. And at that moment, I started stretching my body to relieve the pain of carrying that backpack, and it was so soothing that I had a profound experience of like kindness and groundedness and awe about myself. That turned into my yoga practice and started my recovery. I didn't know that was called yoga at the time. This was back in 1989 and yoga wasn't that well known. I was in graduate school studying to be a mental health therapist. My master's is in transpersonal counseling and art therapy. And I quickly integrated yoga into my studies. And my professors at the university were in support of that. We had meditation as a part of our master's program, so yoga was an easy integration. And I just kept going down that path, led by intuition. And in fact, when you're in recovery, when your body feels better, your intuition is that much more clear too. So I always had this magnetic tug in the direction that I've come.
What about Hunger, Hope, and Healing? This is your book. What would people expect from reading this? What have you put in here, and what is the goal?
Well, the goal is to help people recover, but first and foremost, when I wrote the book, I wanted it to be such that if a woman picks it up and she's been in distress or she's been isolated or anxious or overwhelmed, she can hear me talking directly to her and get a sense that I really understand. I wanted the book to be a medium for empathy and connectedness. And then there's tools in the book to help actually set up your recovery, starting with what we call the first stage of recovery. I call it self-nurturing discipline, which means rather than punitive discipline, can we cultivate the skillful discipline that nurtures us? Like, for example, staying hydrated. How many people on a daily basis are aware of the kindness to their body if they hydrate? A lot of our health problems are actually based on dehydration, and including food disorders, there's a dehydrating component to that. So in the book, step by step, you first learn how to self-nurture, and then I teach the reader about self-empathy, looking at how they got where they are and why it actually makes sense, why it's no longer helpful or needed, and what they can do differently. And the third stage of recovery in the book is called forgiveness and freedom. means to forgive ourselves for the pain we've been in, or even the pain that we've caused to ourselves or others, and to find real freedom in living in your body intelligence, with your intuition, with your innate sense of compassion and clarity.
I wanted to ask you a few more things, and one was gender, because are you seeing predominantly women? Is your book intended for predominantly women?
Well, Shambhala asked me to write this book, which I was honored to hear from them at their request. They asked for a book for women. Men can read the book, and I hope I'm speaking to both, though I know that the issue we face with disordered eating is predominantly in women still. Now, in adolescents and children, both genders are more strongly affected every year. The rising rate of eating disorders in children is really astronomical. I do work with men, but I work with them individually one-to-one. I don't have enough men to form a small group yoga therapy practice like I do for women. I have women's groups twice a week here at the studio, and I see women individually and on retreat and in workshop settings. So there's more demand from women right now than there is from men, but I do work with men.
Okay, fair enough. And I wanted to ask about your two nonprofits. What are they?
My first nonprofit I founded in 1998. It's called Living Yoga, and we teach yoga in the prison system, in drug and alcohol rehab, and for marginalized youth. My second nonprofit I founded in 2012. It's called the Daya Foundation, and it's our yoga therapy clinic here in Southwest Portland. So we seek to support people with medical concerns ranging from anxiety, PTSD, depression, to Parkinson's, ankylosing spondylitis, spinal cord injuries. We also work in the correctional system with the officers to help build their resilience and wellness. And we're working in drug and alcohol rehab where there's a coexisting chronic pain syndrome. We also work in the school system with children who have sensory motor deficits and learning challenges.
And I'm assuming that some of this certainly falls under yoga for, if not all, yoga for social justice. And,
yes.
You know, it's interesting because when you first mentioned going into the prisons in your first nonprofit, I thought, okay, I get that. And then you mentioned corrections officers in the second, and I was like, huh. So how did that come about?
The Department of Corrections called me and asked me to help because correctional officers, both men and women, are exposed to daily traumatizing environments. So they have primary and secondary trauma. It changes how their brains are functioning. It changes endocrine, digestive, and immune function. They start to have health problems, including mental health like anxiety, PTSD. They were seeing a rising rate of addiction and suicide. Correctional officers are more likely to commit suicide by 38% over any other field, even veterans coming home from war. So the DOC called me to see if I could help lessen those complications. And we set up a program with my co-teacher, whose name is Fleet Mall. And we teach, based on his curriculum and my knowledge, how officers can re-stabilize, restore, and come back to themselves.
Now, do they come to you or you're going there?
I go to the prison to facilitate groups of 10 or so at a time.
Wow.
And we have a 10-week program, so they're committed for 10 weeks of this particular teaching. And it's all based on yoga therapy, mindfulness, meditation, and learning leadership skills, including self-leadership, like leadership over your thoughts, and then leadership in your community. Like, how do you create culture change? For an officer to actually take his or her break, like their union-supported break, is a big deal. To just walk outside and not be a CO for 10 minutes on their break, we've actually had to encourage that pretty wholeheartedly.
Sarah Joy Marsh is a Portland, Oregon yoga scholar, recovered food addict, and advocate for using yoga for social justice. She also recently penned Hunger, Hope, and Healing, a guidebook to recovery from disordered eating, food addiction, and body image issues. Earlier this year, a California Court of Appeals upheld a ruling that teaching yoga in school neither violates the Constitution nor promotes Eastern religions. Sandeep Roy reports for KALW.
It's safe to do yoga in American schools. The Fourth District Court of Appeals has ruled that the yoga mat is not some black magic carpet that will deliver American schoolchildren into the clutches of some exotic Eastern religion. The downward dog is just a downward dog and not a Hindu Trojan horse that wants to conquer America. That, by the way, is being done by the all-you-can-eat lunch buffet. But that's another story. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. Yoga, the court has reassured some anxious Encinitas school district parents, is not just secular, it is now a distinctly American cultural phenomenon. No kidding. My friend Rajaswini Bhansali once told me she's often the odd one out in a yoga class.
I would say in 16 years, I've seen 3 to 4 South Asians. I must have taken, 400 or 500 classes.
Sharanjit Sandhu, a yoga teacher of Indian origin in San Francisco, went to the motherland to study yoga.
So I have gone to India and studied, and I have looked to see how India teaches yoga. I've studied in Rishikesh in 1999. I immersed myself in a Tantra yoga program. And then yet I studied with a Romanian teacher. And uniquely enough, I was one of the only Indian students studying in this group.
In fact, in India, there's great anxiety that yoga has slipped out of its grasp and Western gurus are oming and namasteing their way to the bank. The new Indian prime minister wants to put the Indian back in yoga. He asked the UN to declare a World Yoga Day.
Yoga is a invaluable yoga contribution of our country, of our tradition.
Karma.
Yoga.
संयम
our heart, our
व उपलब्धि की योग दिवस को आरंभ करने की दिशा में
and
कार्य करें
towards international yoga day.
He has even appointed a minister in charge of yoga. India wants the world to acknowledge that yoga wasn't the product of immaculate conception out of a studio in California. It's part of a centuries-old Hindu tradition. Even Indians don't acknowledge that enough. Naveen Chandra, who goes to yoga classes in San Francisco and yoga camps around the world, has seen it firsthand.
I have to say, though, the vast majority of yoga teachers have studied Hinduism more than I have, or my parents have, and they do understand a lot more. And I'm learning more about the meanings of the shlokas and the intention of Hinduism than I ever knew as a kid growing up being taught Hinduism from my community.
And that's where the court verdict is a mixed blessing. It's a blow against those trying to twist yoga into some sinister Eastern conspiracy. But in the process, it could also turn yoga into just another exercise routine, like Pilates or aerobics. Yoga is not Hinduism, but the Om chant in yoga class isn't just spiritual mumbo-jumbo either, says Sharanjit.
It's a very powerful way to get your brain moving into the right brain, which is a very present moment, instead of the left brain, which is past and future.
And if yoga becomes just about exercise shorn of spirituality, then it also becomes more about the designer yoga mat, says Rajaswini.
First time I picked up a copy of the yoga journal, I was flabbergasted because 80% of it is advertisements for different types of products and the yoga wear and the type of right pant and the right cut of shirt. And nowadays you have those yoga mat carriers, you know.
And if you're the only Indian in yoga class, may the force be with you, Sharanjit.
My teacher, in fact, joked with me and said, oh, maybe Sharon can teach us how to pronounce the Sanskrit words better than any one of us. And I laughed and said, no, I can't.
Sharanjit didn't learn yoga because her South Asian culture was calling to her, but for therapeutic reasons after a running injury. When she became a yoga instructor, she says her father didn't say, oh, how wonderful Sharanjit is getting in touch with her heritage. He was not unhappy.
I think overall, the impression that he has of yoga, it's good for you, you know. I wasn't taking guitar lessons and wanting to be like Jimi Hendrix and saying, Dad, I want to be a rock star.
But she did discover the rich culture of her forebears thanks to yoga. And so there is something lost, or at least something denied, when in order to become more all-American, that school in Encinitas calls the Padmasana or the lotus pose crisscross applesauce. It's great that an Indian tradition has found an American home. But does that mean yoga needs to go homeless? This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Aaja maji, aaja maji, loye, loye.
now, writer Dr. Jerry Burns draws a connection between yoga and storytelling.
Writer Tresca Weinstein wonders why she can't do her yoga practice at home. In a thoughtful blog post for Sonima, a wellness website, she examines this question. Her intriguing insights about yoga are also super relevant to the power of storytelling. With over 20 years of yoga classes under her agile belt, Tresca finds that the group class experience is starkly different from solo practice. Whenever she tries to practice at home, she feels empty and unengaged. But in group classes, Tresca feels the buzz. She bends and twists into vibrant shapes with more power and ease than she can at home. One might say that when she's in yoga class, her stretching is, well, stretched. She explains it like this. Yogis have known forever that something magical happens when people move, breathe, or meditate in sync. It's an effect sometimes called entraining, when a group's energy aligns, heightening the focus and awareness in the room. A yoga teacher might call it raising the vibration. I love that explanation. It parallels how storytelling works. Magic really does happen when stories are told live in groups. The community of listeners is aligned in their emotional response to the story being told. Heightened awareness of other listeners and the emotional resonance impacts the way the story is told and heard. Listening to a story together raises the vibration of the storytelling experience. It's not the same to listen to stories alone on headphones or to watch stories online. Even if the experience of online or digital storytelling is creative, interactive, and gorgeously artistic, it's different from listening live with others. Imagine sitting by yourself at a table in a cafe watching a video on your phone or taking in a multimedia narrative on your computer. Imagine sucking in your breath at a tense or surprising moment in that digital story. Remember, you're the only one in that cafe experiencing the story. Although there are many other people in real space all around you, you are alone in the story world. Because of your solitary experience of the story, you're not as likely to suck in that breath as you might be if everyone else in the cafe were involved along with you. So, what happens if you bravely suck in your breath anyway? The resonance of that sucking in moment will be diminished because you are the only one doing it. In an audience of one, there's no one else to raise the vibration. Tresca interviews a yoga teacher, and together they share this meaty tidbit. Among the three jewels of Buddhist mindfulness teachings, Buddha, awakening, Dharma, the path or teachings, and Sangha, a community of like-minded practitioners, the Buddha taught that the most important was Sangha. The yoga teacher also added, "We're part of a 2,500-year-old tradition of gathering together to practice." Storytelling, like yoga, is an old tradition built on gathering together. The Sangha of storytelling, experiencing a story in the same time and space as others, is an experience that elevates narrative and community. I mean, if the Buddha thought it was important. So, does this mean that solitary consumption of online storytelling is no good? No way. Human beings want and need stories in all forms and forums. The creative doorways that technology has opened for us are groundbreaking and brilliant. We can and should embrace narrative online, on screen, on paper, and wherever else we find it, including on stage or in the living room with a storyteller and other listeners. If you haven't done it lately, jump into an audience and listen to stories told live. Remind yourself how it feels to raise the vibration and revel in the Sangha of storytelling.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. And that's our storytelling for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1368.